This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In an article called What Are We Going to Do with Dad?, my guest, Dr. Gerald Winokur, eloquently described the dilemmas facing adult children trying to help make the right medical choices for elderly parents caught in a downward spiral of failing health, disability, and dementia. Dr. Winokur knows all about the related problems from his experiences as a son and geriatric physician. He was the founding director of the skilled nursing unit at Methodist Hospital in San Antonio. He's in private practice and teaches at the Center for Medical Humanities and Ethics at the University of Texas Health Science Center. His article, What Are We Going to Do with Dad?, was first published in a policy journal called Health Affairs. When a shorter version was published last week in the Washington Post, it struck a nerve. He's received about 800 emails. I asked him to read the beginning of his article.
My father is 86 years old. He was never a big man, except perhaps to me when I was his little boy. At most, he was 5 feet 8 inches tall and weighed 160 pounds. Today, he weighs barely 120. Maybe he is 5 feet 2. He teeters on spindly legs, a parched blade of grass in the wind, refusing the walker his doctor recommends, or the arm extended in support by those of us who love him. He doesn't know what day it is. He sleeps most of the time, barely eats. Shaving exhausts him. His clothes hang like a scarecrow's. Getting him in for a haircut is a major ordeal. He is very deaf, but won't wear his hearing aids, or loses them as often as a kid might misplace his marbles. He drives my mother, 5 years younger, crazy to tears. My only sibling, the architect, asks me every time we are together, which is often because we all live in the same town, and every time we speak on the phone, which is almost every day, because we are a close family now in crisis. What are we going to do with Dad? As if there must be a definitive answer, some fix, say putting a grab bar in the bathroom or increasing the width of the doorways, something that is according to code. He asks me this question not just out of fear and frustration, not only out of a realization that it is time for the adult children of a progressively dementing elderly parent to act, but because he figures that his older brother, who has been practicing medicine for almost 30 years, should know the answer. I do not know the answer. I do not have a pat solution for my father or yours, neither as a son, a man past middle age with grown children of his own, nor as a doctor, a specialist in geriatrics, and a credentialed long-term care medical director.
It's my guest, Dr. Gerald Winokur, reading from his article, What Are We Going to Do with Dad? Dr. Winokur, welcome to Fresh Air. Where is your father now?
My father is at home in San Antonio, Texas. He and my mother are living in the same small two-bedroom home that they've lived in for the last 25 years. They live just a couple of blocks from where I live. And he has not progressed much over the last year or so, although, as most people know, a dementing elderly parent does progress slowly, and we have noticed a definite loss in function. But I'm able to keep him at home still, and I'm happy that I'm able to do that.
I'd like to talk with you about your experiences with your father and your experiences practicing geriatric medicine. You know, in this article that you read from, you describe the hospital as one of the most dangerous places for the elderly. You say it's almost a miracle that any elderly patient gets out of the hospital today relatively unscathed. Now, you'd think it would be the other way around. I mean, you want to feel that when, you know, say an elderly parent is in the hospital, that that's when they're most protected. They have 24-hour care. There's somebody taking care of their diet. There's nurses. There's doctors. There's somebody on call all the time. Why do you think of it as actually a dangerous place?
The difficulty with elderly patients is even if they've never displayed any evidence of confusion or disorientation before a hospital stay, when they get sick, when they get ill, when they get admitted to a hospital, which is a strange and threatening environment, and they're around strangers who they don't know, and they're put on medications for their symptoms, be they pain medicines, or medicines for nausea, or medicines for sleep. All of this has a profound effect on someone who's elderly. And there are various terms for what happens to elderly patients in the hospital, terms such as delirium or sundowning. But elderly patients get confused, and they try to get out of bed. Suddenly there are bed rails there. They try to negotiate bed rails. They trip. There's IV poles. There's lines to get hung up in. So it's been my experience, and I think the experience of most physicians that care for elderly patients, that things happen to them despite the fact that there are nurses at the nurse's station. If no one is by their bedside watching out for them, things can happen. I don't mean to imply, Terry, that this is negligence, but this is something that is it's unpredictable, but to someone who takes care of a lot of elderly patients, it is predictable. And I try to do what I can to protect my patients when I admit them. And the most important thing that I do is I tell the family, if you can, please stay with him or for your dad or your mother, or have a sitter by their bed.
Your father was hospitalized not long ago for congestive heart failure. And you say that you watched him get into a downward spiral while he was in the hospital for reasons not directly related to the heart problems. What happened to your father?
My father had been showing some signs of dementia even before that admission. We noticed that he would have some difficulty, for example, finding the right key to put in the front door lock, and he would have some trouble. My mother would cover for him. But I knew what was happening. And I also knew when he went into the hospital for congestive heart failure that he was just the kind of patient that was going to be confused there. And I stayed with him. Either my brother stayed with him or I stayed with him 24/7. And it was a good thing I did, because within two nights of being there, he was totally confused. And he was paranoid. He didn't really understand why he was there. He was fearful when people came in to do things to him, like draw blood or just coming in to take his vital signs. And I found myself having to calm him down. As I described in my piece, I would talk to him, stroke his arm, and try to settle him down. I did not want to give him medications if I could help it. And as long as I was there trying to calm him and reassure him, I was able to keep a lid on the situation.
And you say when you weren't able to be with him, or when your brother wasn't, you'd hire a sitter. A sitter is basically an aide who can help out with what kind of things?
Well, a sitter is just a person that's going to be in the room with him. Or if, say, my father would have had to go for a test, the sitter would have gone. And the sitter's job is to watch my father or watch a patient when a procedure is going to be done. Patients, for example, will be put on an X-ray table, and the X-ray tech is not necessarily familiar with the patient's medical history, but may walk out of the room for a second. Well, that's just the time that somebody like my father might decide he's going to get up because he has to go to the bathroom. And he doesn't know where he is or where he's going, and the next thing you know, he could slip and fall. So a sitter is there as another reassuring hand and to just watch out for an elderly person.
Now you said that the biggest concerns that you had about your father, it wasn't like negligent health care, was more issues pertaining to disorientation.
Yes.
But what about health problems with health care delivery for patients who are elderly? I'm thinking, for instance, you know, good deal. You got the hospital food. It's being delivered three times a day. Chances are, you know, the patient's going to get some food. On the other hand, sometimes the patient's too sick to actually feed themselves or too weak. And I've seen it when the food tray is delivered and the food tray is picked up and the patient has been too weak to eat anything. Nobody really notices or cares. And it's as if there was no food at all.
Unfortunately, that happens, Terry. I think this is where the role of the primary doctor or the primary geriatrician really comes into play. Physicians like myself try to anticipate when a patient might not eat and write specific orders to cover that. For example, I might write an order, this patient is confused, this patient needs assistance with feeding, please sit this patient up in a chair and assist with feeding if necessary. This gives the nurses a heads up. I find that this is very important. Sometimes the nurses don't really understand what is going on with the patient. They're not the admitting physicians, and although they read the chart, they change. They change every shift, every 8 hours, there's somebody new coming on, and they're getting the report from the nurse on the previous shift. And the directions might change. The emphasis might change. Very often it's not the primary care geriatrician that's admitting the patient to the hospital. The patient may be admitted by his urologist to deal with a specific prostate problem, or being admitted by his or her orthopedist to have a knee procedure or a hip procedure done. Ideally, the geriatrician should know about this, but sometimes the primary doctor doesn't know. And frankly, the specialists aren't in tune with these little day-to-day, shift-to-shift, important management orders that the primary care doctor writes.
Let's get back to your father. Your father was hospitalized for congestive heart failure, and his problems with dementia were growing while he was hospitalized. After he was hospitalized, you say he was the perfect candidate for a skilled nursing unit to be there for, what, a week or two or three. You didn't want him to go there. You wanted to get him home right away. In fact, you say you thought he'd never get home if you let him go to a skilled nursing unit. Now, you run a skilled nursing unit. What were your worries?
Well, with my father, given his particular circumstance, I felt that if I didn't get him back into familiar surroundings, he would remain paranoid and confused, and I wouldn't be able to take him home again. You're right, until my hospital closed the skilled nursing unit, I was a medical director there for 9 years. We helped an awful lot of people. But my father became so confused and so paranoid that I knew that he wasn't going to be able to cooperate with the physical therapists or the occupational therapists, which is one of the main reasons you admit patients to the SNU. And I knew that he was not going to get reoriented continuing to stay in a strange place. So I made the decision to take him home. Within a matter of a couple of 3 days, he was, I don't want to say, he never got back to his baseline, but he was comfortable in his home. We had some help there. My mother was there. My brother and I were there all the time. And he began to get back to himself a little bit. Now, Terry, I should add this. I'm very fortunate. I'm a doctor. I'm a geriatrician. I know about the problems with pharmacology in the elderly. But I was able, with input from his physician, to make little changes in his dosages of certain of the medications that he came home with. I could make changes every day if I felt I needed to. Most people don't have that ability because, what are they seeing their doctor? Maybe a week or 2 weeks after they first go home from the hospital. So I was able to judge how my father was doing, and I could say he's under-medicated or he's over-medicated, and I can make changes in his medicines daily. And I realize it's a major advantage I have that most people don't have, but I felt that I could use that advantage to deal with him at home better and perhaps get him back on his feet at home rather than in a skilled unit.
So you ran a skilled nursing unit of a hospital in San Antonio, Texas for 9 years. Why are patients sent to the skilled nursing unit?
Skilled nursing units, I feel, are really valuable adjunct, despite the fact that I didn't use one from my father. Skilled nursing units have sort of come in to fill a void. For example, the usual hospital stay for a fractured hip nowadays is about 3 days. Well, Very few elderly patients that fall and break a hip are ready to go home after 3 days. They need some physical therapy. They need to start eating. They need to have a bowel movement. Well, this doesn't happen in 3 days necessarily. So with the advent of skilled units, you could send a patient to a skilled unit in a hospital, in a nursing home, expect the adjunctive therapies such as physical therapy or occupational therapy or respiratory therapy, say if a patient was had a lot of congestion in their chest. Usually there's a geriatric nurse practitioner and a social worker, and they can help with after discharge arrangements, which take some time arranging. So you've got the patient in a unit that's not as heavily staffed as an acute care unit, but better staffed than a custodial nursing home.
I'm sure you've had to deal with a lot of patients who had children or other relatives who cared a lot but lived far away. And even if they were able to make a trip to the nursing unit, they couldn't stay for long because of other, you know, family or work responsibilities. So I'm wondering what advice you have for people in that predicament from your perspective as a geriatric physician.
When you have an elderly parent and he or she begins what I call in this article this progressive spiral toward disability or dementia or repeat hospital admissions for a same condition, maybe it's congestive heart failure, maybe it's for respiratory problems if they are they have emphysema. But once you see the spiral developing and your parents live far away from you, a useful piece of advice is, you know, you've got to make a decision. Your life is going to continually be disrupted by these acute episodes of illness. And although it may be a hard conversation to have with your mother and father, sometimes it is incumbent upon a child, especially an adult child, to say, listen, the time has come for us to have a serious conversation. You need to come to a more secure place. You need to be where I can oversee your care. It's time for you to move.
Between your father and your patients, you've seen people in a very debilitated state. What are your worst fears about eventually facing old age yourself? I mean, you've seen absolutely everything that can go wrong.
Well, I can tell you one thing. I'm not in denial about it. I know that I'm getting older myself, and I know that despite all the technical advances in medicine over the last decades, that we've been able to extend life, but we haven't been able really to give much quality to end of life. That still comes from the individual person. That still comes from some person's will to get up every morning, take a walk, eat properly, do some exercise, keep one's mind active, do puzzles, read and write. And I find that my patients that do that, that have the spirit and the will to do that every day, they're the ones that have the quality in their later years.
I'm sure you've had a lot of patients who are cognitively impaired. I mean, they don't recognize their family. They don't remember much about their lives. They're very disoriented. But their vitals are good. You know, their mind is kind of gone, but their vitals are good. And what kind of dilemmas do you think that presents to us in terms of what kind of health care is most appropriate in that kind of situation?
I do believe that even severely cognitively impaired people can live in the moment. My father, although he really remembers nothing about the whole middle of his life, he remembers a bit about his childhood, but on his good days, he's in the moment. And if I'm there with him or my brother are there with him, we can have a conversation about something that's happening in the moment. We can talk about something that we've just seen on television, say a football play. My father really can't follow any plots anymore, stories or movies, but he can watch a sports game, and we can talk about it. And my brother says, and he's right, he says, you know, any time I can go over to Dad's and make him laugh, I think it's been a good visit.
You've talked about the importance of, if and when it comes to it, learning to make some decisions on the part of your elderly parent if they have dementia and they really can't be relied on to make those decisions for themselves, even that if that decision means uprooting them, you know, making the decision to uproot them and move them to where you live. Was it difficult for you to learn to take on the role of parent to your own father?
It was difficult for both of us. I think that it happened gradually over a period of several years. Now, of course, it's total and complete. But it was very difficult for us. My father and I had some conflicts that were probably unresolved for many years. This is very common in families. But when I started making the decisions, particularly when I took away his car keys and sold his car, he was not happy. But there is no question in my mind that was the right thing to do.
Can we talk about that a little bit? What was the point when you knew you had to take the car keys away? And what did he say when you did it?
My father was getting lost. He rarely went any place by himself, but occasionally he and my mother would go out to dinner. And although they've lived in the same neighborhood for 25 years, and although my mother's vision is very poor, my father would suddenly start taking wrong turns, and she would know it. And she would try to correct him and said, you know, Leonard, you know, you need to go back the other way. And, of course, he didn't accept it. And he would get angry, and he says, I know where I'm going. Well, when this started happening, I said, well, Mom, we've got to take the car away. And I worked on this for a couple of months, and my father didn't accept it. Finally, I sold the car. Car just disappeared from his driveway. And you know what, Terry? He grumbled about it for a week or two, and then he actually said to me, well, I think that was the best thing.
With your patients, you often have to convince them to do things for their own good. You know, like, I know you've had patients that don't want to use their hearing aid even though they really need it. They don't want to use a walker even though it's dangerous for them to walk without it. Why do you think so many older people resist doing things that they clearly need to do?
Well, Terry, I think all of us are in denial about our eventual declines and demise. Americans have a great ambivalence about getting old and dying. And older people, of course, they see that their independence is slipping away by degree, and they don't want to give it up. They're just like the rest of us. I believe, from my years of doctoring, that if I know a patient, even if it's a cantankerous individual, if I've known a patient for a while, the children may not be able to get that individual to give up the automobile. His spouse may not be able to get him or her to give up the automobile. But if they come into me and we talk about it together, I almost always, over a couple of visits, can get that patient to see where I'm coming from. And I use rather standard arguments. I say, you know, there was a season to cease driving just as there was a season to begin driving. Sometimes I can get a little harsher and say, you know, Mr. So-and-so, If you want to drive your car and wreck it and hurt yourself, that's one thing. But, you know, you'll probably injure an innocent individual. You don't want to do that. And they'll think about it. And it's coming from me and not their son or not their daughter. And with time, because I know these folks and they trust me, most of the time they will listen. It may not happen all at once.
You've talked a lot about your father, and I know your mother's 5 years younger, but you know, often what you see is that the parent that has been the capable parent, the parent that has their health and full cognitive abilities, starts to get older too, and they're no longer in the position to take care of the parent who hasn't been well. Is that starting to happen in your family?
That happens all the time, and it's happening in my family. And the help that we have at home is as much for my mother as for my father, although I'm not sure she really realizes that yet. And we've talked, we've had some conversations saying, you know, if there comes a time when we can't manage Dad at home, and he has to go into custodial long-term care, if that does happen, if that time comes, you know, Mom, you're still going to need to have help at home. Right now, she just shrugs, but it's a process.
You teach at the Center for Medical Humanities and Ethics on the campus of the University of Texas. And in addition to being a physician, you're also a writer. You write poetry, you write essays, and the essays I've read are really quite beautifully written.
Thank you.
And I think that's a talent that you actually use at the Center for Medical Humanities and Ethics, where film and writing is used as a way to help teach future doctors about people and medicine. How exactly do you use writing in this program?
I've been fortunate, and along with my wife, Lee Robinson, to get to know Dr. Abraham Verghese, who you've interviewed on your show, Terry. He's a wonderful physician writer, and he was recruited to be the director of the Center for Medical Humanities and Ethics. Believe it or not, before he came to this health science center, teaching medical ethics to medical students was not a high priority. And if it was taught in rather dry philosophical terms that, frankly, a lot of medical students tune out. What Dr. Verghese and his associate, Dr. Therese Jones, have done is to put together a course based on narrative. They are teaching medical students the foundational principles of medical ethics by short story, by film. The beauty to me is that this program is designed to nurture the idealism that these students come to medical school with, and that is can be so easily trampled out of them throughout their 4 years of medical education and then their residencies. We give them permission to talk about these difficult issues, some of which we've talked about today, end-of-life issues, dying, suffering, pain relief, euthanasia. We all very tough issues to talk about, but we give them permission to talk about them. And we also give them permission to feel very conflicted and ambivalent and sad. When I was a medical student, if you showed any of those characteristics, you were likely to be drummed out of the Corps. I was told when I was a medical student, you're too soft for this. You're never going to make it as a doctor. Well, we don't do that. And I'm really happy to be a part of it.
Well, Dr. Winokur, thanks so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Dr. Gerald Winokur is a geriatric physician who teaches at the Center for Medical Humanities and Ethics at the University of Texas Health Science Center in San Antonio. His article, What Are We Going to Do About Dad?, was published in Health Affairs and The Washington Post. You can find a link on our website at freshair.npr.org. Fiddler Vassar Clements died earlier this week at the age of 77 of lung cancer. Early in his career, from 1949 to 1956, he played with the seminal bluegrass group Bill Monroe and his Bluegrass Boys. He went on to make many albums under his own name and also recorded with such diverse musicians as Paul McCartney, the Grateful Dead, and Johnny Cash. Here he is playing Orange Blossom Special with the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band in 1972.